one should not distinguish in what one does between means and ends. One should think in terms of package deal. I have two alternatives, A and B. If I do A, what will happen? Some things will happen immediately, and some things will happen long term, and there'll be a sum total of effects. I do B, there's another package. And then what I do is to evaluate the packages and say which is the better package. Nothing at all hangs, should hang, could hang, on calling some of the things that happen means some of the things that happen ends. The whole question, do the ends justify the means, is a red herring. One shouldn't ask that question. Nothing but confusion will come from asking that question. What one should ask is, given my alternatives, which alternative gives me the best package deal? So when you talk about amputating a gangrenous limb, it's not that the end of saving his life justifies the means of cutting off his leg. That's not the clearest way to put it. The clearest way to put it is, I have two alternatives. Cut off the leg and he lives, versus leaving the leg alone and he dies. Clearly, life without a leg is better than dying. So the package of cutting off his leg and living is better than the package of dying. You need the vocabulary of means and ends, and introducing it can only cause confusion. What I mean here is, although I spoke about means, because it's intuitive in this context to speak that way, but the more accurate statement would be, the package of evil leading, evil plus good resulting from the evil, is a better package than no evil and lacking that resulting good. It's a better package. Nothing hangs on the means and ends terminology. Okay, that's just a footnote to avoid possible confusion. Now, the problem that was raised, rightly, at the end yesterday, last week was, how can you say that a certain means or a certain part of the package is necessary when you're talking about an all-powerful being? How can anything be necessary for an all-powerful being? That seems to be just a straightforward contradiction. He's all-powerful, then nothing necessary. You're saying that we have A because with A we can get B, and without A we can't. If God is all-powerful, he should be able to achieve B without A. And then you have no justification for A. The answer that I said to you briefly last week was this. To raise the possibility of God's doing something, anything, under any condition, in any discussion, to raise the possibility of God's doing something, we have to be consistent in our description of the thing to be done. If we contradict ourselves in the describing of the thing to be done, then we have failed to describe. And if we have failed to describe, then we're not raising the question. To raise the question, could God do X? Why didn't God do X? Wouldn't X have been better? The X slot has to be filled by words that make sense. If the words don't make any sense, then we're not asking a sensible question. One condition words have to fulfill to make sense is they don't contradict themselves. Now, the response to the query, not an answer to a question, but the response to the challenge, couldn't God have achieved the end without this necessary prelude? The answer is, if you try to describe achieving the end without the prelude, you'll see that you're contradicting yourself. And that's why the question is not a sensible question. As I said last week, I'm not going to claim that God couldn't do it otherwise. That would make it sound like there is an alternative, but he can't do it. What I'm going to claim is that trying to describe getting to the good without the prelude of the evil is going to fail. The trying to describe is going to fail. The person asking the question is going to fail to give a consistent description. And therefore, he's not asking a question. That's the way I believe the answer works. Now, that's what I told you last week, but I didn't explain to you at all how the description goes wrong. The general picture, and I will fill in the details, but I want the general picture to be understood, I hope. is this. You start with the description of the good that you want to achieve. And they say, well, to achieve that good A, we have to have B. In order to have B, we have to have C. In order to have C, we have to have D. And the D will be the evil. That is the prayer. Now, what do I mean have to have? To get A, you have to have B. What I mean is that logic alone takes you from A to B. Logic alone takes you from B to C. Logic alone takes you from C to D. So, you have a logical chain from A to D. Someone who therefore queries, but what about doing A without D, means that he's taking the beginning of a logical chain and denying the end of a logical chain. And that's a contradiction. And that means he's not giving a consistent description of what it is he's proposing should be done. And that is why logic is relevant. One deep philosophical question is, how can you use logic to meditate on what God does? Who says that our logic is accurate? Who says our logic is relevant at all? The deepest answer, I believe, is if you don't use human logic, then when you talk about what God does, you're not making sense. It's not God's fault, it's your fault. You're trying to raise questions about what he did and why he didn't do something else and why he did was the best thing rather than something else. If you're raising that question, then you're undertaking the responsibility to make sense. If you contradict yourself, you're not making sense. So it's all built into our responsibility to talk in a sensible way. It has nothing to do with testing God's power or abilities. Now, let's go briefly through the description of the end and why evil is necessary as a means to, or it's necessary as a prelude. It's part of the package of achieving that good. The good is possessing godliness, possessing as much of God's being as a creature can possess. That is the good because he's the greatest good. So as much of his being as we can possess, the more good we're going to possess. God creates us so that we can possess as much good as a creature can possess, as much of God's being as a creature can possess, and that way have as much of the good as can be available to a creature. Now, part of God's good, part of God's perfection, is being self-determined, not dependent on another, self-contained, self-sufficient. Any being that depends upon another is not perfect. A creature can't be totally self-contained, totally self-determined, because it is a creature. It's created. It's created by God, then of course it isn't totally self-determined. But a creature can be partly self-determined if that creature can act on its own to, so to speak, self-create on its own. So if the creature is left partly undetermined and given the power to act on its own so that its actions will fill in the missing space in its own identity, then the creature will be partly self-determined. And in that respect, the creature will be godly. Godly is short for God-like. It will possess characters similar to God. That's what free will does. And indeed, as I understand it, free will is just another word for the power to act on your own, not to be totally determined by God. And in that way, to be similar to God in that you are partly self-determined. True, there are differences. He's totally self-determined. We're partly self-determined. He's self-determined because of his very nature. We're self-determined by free will. There are differences. But there also is a similarity. That part of what we are is what we are because of us. You ask, why are you that way? Certain things about me, the answer is because I did this. That's why I am that way. Not because something outside of me determined. So, the ability to act on our own is necessary for us to be godlike, which is necessary for us to possess the greatest possible good. Now, if at this point, someone were to say, but you're talking about God. Why can't God give man the greatest possible good without us having free will, without us exercising free will? That suggestion harbors a contradiction. It's no better than square circles. Because God is the greatest possible good, that's true by definition. Part of God's perfection is the self-determinedness, that's also part of the definition of perfection. And free will is just a name for the ability to be in part self-determined, without which we wouldn't have that piece of God's being, that piece of God's goodness. So the suggestion, why couldn't God give us the greatest good without giving us free will and making us partly self-determined, is a suggestion of square circles. Since it's square circles, no significant question has been asked, no meaningful question has been asked. You with me? Now, evil, in our definition, our house definition, is God's hiddenness, the inability to perceive God clearly, openly. But that itself is necessary because if you perceive God openly, clearly, then free will would be impossible. You'd be overwhelmed by God's presence to the point where you couldn't make a free decision against what He commands. So hiddenness, which is the root of all evil, is the starting point and the root of all what we call later evil. That hiddenness is a necessary condition of free will. Without it, free will would be impossible. God can't fill the space with His presence and then expect the creature in the space to act against what God wants. Now, all of the evils that we describe as evils have as their root this hiding of God's presence, which He does. He does it. Which means, on this picture, He does evil. And that enables all sorts of other evils to come into existence. Evils that we perform. All of them have their root in making us, giving us the capacity to be independent and self-determined in some respects. That's why the suggestion, but why couldn't He achieve the good end without the prelude of evil, is a nonsensical question, because it's a logical chain of deduction from the good end to the existence of evil. So someone who asks why you can't have one without the other, someone is asking why there aren't square circles. That is not a sensible question. Yeah.
Didn't you start off by saying that evil is not part of God? Now you're saying it is God hidden?
I said that God does evil. That we can describe God as doing evil. Let's go back to the doctor analogy. What was the point of the analogy of the doctor? He gives an injection, which immunizes the child and hurts him. And we said, part of that action is good and part of that action is evil. Hurting the child is evil. What was the proof of that? Because when they invent pills, you don't expect the doctor to keep using the needle. So using the needle is definitely evil. And then we said, shall we then conclude that the doctor did an action which is partly good and partly evil, so the doctor is partly good and partly evil? And we said, no, you don't have to conclude that. The doctor may be all good. But what? Since the evil in this case, which is the child's faith, is a necessary means to immunizing him against the, or the necessary part of the package of immunizing him against the disease, so the agent, the doctor as agent, can be wholly good, his purpose can be wholly good, and he himself can do an evil. So I'm using that as an analogy to God doing evil. Yeah.
But a doctor is not a perfect being, so a doctor might not have the same power, but God as a perfect being, couldn't God have the power to do it only through good then?
Okay, so that's exactly the question that I was just answering. So let's review. The suggestion, couldn't God achieve the good without going through evil, for that to be a sensible suggestion, this description achieving the good without the evil has to be a consistent description. If in that description there is a contradiction, then it's like asking, but couldn't God make square circles? And that is not a sensible question, because the person asking the question is contradicting himself in asking the question. That means it's not a sensible question. Now, what I've described is why suggesting God achieved this good without this evil is a contradiction. It's no better than square circles. In those words, there lies a contradiction. What's the contradiction? Well, if the good is possessing his being, and his being involves self-determinateness, and the self-determinateness for us requires free will, and free will for us requires him to hide, and hiddenness is the root of evil, you see that you cannot get to that end without this root of evil existing. To suggest that you could get there without this would mean to be contradicting yourself, which is not a sensible suggestion. That's the answer, yeah.
It's not really answered the question why good happens to bad people and bad happens to good people.
Well, that requires carrying out the effect of evil vis-a-vis free will further. And since you asked it that way, I'll give you just a little bit. There are at least 30 different reasons in the tradition that answer that question, all of which are extensive, what I said. There's an article in a book that I wrote called The Informed Soul, of which there are copies in the library. There's an article in there on suffering. But let's just take a realistic picture of a person making a decision. Now let's imagine we have a world in which good people who make good decisions, right decisions, always receive benefits. Their stocks go up. They never get ill. Rains on their farms. And bad people always get bad consequences. Their stocks go down, and it never rains on their farms. So when the rain in the valley comes in a checkerboard fashion. It rains on these farms, on those farms. They do get sick. You know. People will figure out pretty quickly that it pays to be good. And it's shooting yourself in the foot to be bad. Which means that your motivation is going to be stacked very heavily on the side of doing good because it pays. And then free will with a balanced decision between good and evil is going to become impossible. So indeed, good people have to suffer and bad people have to prosper. Both have to happen. So that in terms of the consequences, it looks like a 50-50 deal. Only then can a person have a balanced free will to decide to do good, not to do evil. Yeah.
So how come in the Torah there's always references to like physical benefits of doing good?
Okay.
And if there is no physical benefit of doing good, why is it changed?
So the answer is this. If you look very carefully, you'll see there's a difference between the descriptions. What I'm telling you now is Rashi. The Ramban says it a little differently, but the Ramban can be explained also. The first paragraph of the Shema, which says that you should fulfill God's commandments, makes no promises whatsoever that if you do good, you'll receive good benefits, and if you do evil, you'll receive punishment. The second paragraph of the Shema does make such promises. Rashi points out that the first paragraph of the Shema is in the singular, and the second paragraph of the Shema is in the plural. And he says the difference is that an individual can live a life which is a good life, a right life, a righteous life, and you will not see correspondence between the actions that he performs and the goods that come, or the evils that he does and the bad things that come. Indeed, some of you last week, I quoted the verse in Deuteronomy, God is a faithful God, no iniquity is in him, righteous and straight is he. And Rashi there says, yes, God is a righteous God, fair God, just God, straight, and therefore for the righteous, he pays them for the righteousness of their actions, in the world to come. Rashi says explicitly, in the world to come, but not in this world. In this world, the righteous can suffer, and the wicked can prosper. No guarantee against that. The second paragraph, which talks about the promises of good and, good things happening for good, and bad things happening for bad, is in the plural. Then it's talking about the nation as a whole.
Word for word.
Well, okay, you're reading English, right?
Yeah.
So you can't tell, right? Yeah. But in the Hebrew, yeah. Or Yim Tishmu'u, Tishmu'u is plural. That whole paragraph is referring to the plural. It's referring to the nation. In the nation, there will be a correspondence between national success and national failure. But that leaves lots of room for individuals. Lots of wiggle room for individuals. You know, leaves room for the nation when it is not clearly successful and not clearly a failure for there to be variations. Only when there's very clear success in serving God, there's a promise that things will go well. And when there's very clear success of failure in serving God, there's a threat that terrible things will happen.
So why is there no reference to Lama Ba anywhere?
Okay, now we're starting off on a single question, which are all important, but they're not in this subject, right? And I want to just caution you. When you say, still, why not? Those words make it sound like I didn't answer the first question. The first question is answered, right?
Yes, good.
Now we're going on something else. Yeah, but there are lots and lots of questions. By the way, tonight is not the rabbi time. So if you answered it to Rabbi Salinger, I'll be glad to answer it tonight. Yeah.
What about Mitzvah makes a reference to doing a small lunch?
So, the usual answer is that it's two things. Number one, it could be long life in this world if other conditions are fulfilled. You don't really expect that a person who sets free the mother bird before it takes the eggs and commits murder is guaranteed long life. Right? It's a judicial law to kill him, right? So if he's caught, the court will kill him. No one will say in his defense, but listen, he freed the mother bird, so therefore he's got to get long life, so he can't kill him. That's written into the law that way. So obviously, these promises are other things being equal, and other things might not be equal. They're not absolute promises. Legally, you could see that they can't be.
But the only exception to that would be things that would merit death, right? If you're...
Yes, but then that could be the sum total of other failures, or it could be other particular failures. It could be all sorts of things. Right? These things are only other things being equal. They're not absolute.
What sum total of things can merit death? Are there only
According to some, if your sum total is over the halfway mark of evil, then you have no right to live altogether. Rambam says this explicitly, that was true. Yeah.
Is it like a system where you function in this world and like God doesn't make a decision every time? And it's sort of like it's like a scale. Everything works like a scale. Like I think punishments or rewards.
Okay, we're going again. This is just I'll answer this briefly, but I'm sure that there are no end of questions that could be asked. You're touching on a very important and deep theme. Amchal talks about this in a number of places. God decided to deal with the world according to certain principles that have nothing to do with His nature. They have nothing to do with His reality, nothing to do with His being. But rather, He decided to operate according to those principles so that we would be able to understand what happens and be able to relate to it. If He would react to the world out of His infinity, there would be no way that we could appreciate what He was doing and why He was doing it. We could not interact with Him, we could not understand Him, we could not be partners with Him. It's a little bit like, James gives this example, you and your dog. How much does your dog understand of what you do? Next to nothing. He relies on the fact that when he does what you say, you pat him on the head and feed him and so forth and so on. But when you move to California, or when you cut off his hair, or when you have him ejected or whatever, he hasn't got a clue why you're doing that. That's why there can be no significant partnership between a human being and a dog. Wouldn't make sense to make a promise to your dog? And then worry about breaking it? Right? Because there's nobody on the other end who can appreciate what a promise is. Yeah, the dog can fetch a newspaper for you. You know. It's a sheep dog, so it can be useful for the sheep. But no significant partnership because we don't understand. So God chose to operate according to principles that we can understand so that it could be a meaningful relationship between us. That doesn't express His being. It expresses how He chose to operate according to us now. There's a day of judgment. And a day of judgment, the whole past year's actions are weighed up and some kind of decision is made. God doesn't need to wait. Doesn't need to be informed. Doesn't need to gather information. God is omniscient. More than that, he's omnipresent. He's present at every moment of space-time, so that the information is available to him continuously, instantly. So, reaction to what we do could flow instantly from what we do. But then, we would have no time to gather it up. We'd have no time to evaluate ourselves. We'd have no time to reflect. We wouldn't be able to interact with the God who would operate under that kind of instantaneous, total knowledge and involvement. So God says, okay, once a year there'll be a major judgment and other kinds of judgment at other times. I'll give you the principles so you can understand them. And you can then interact with them on the basis of those principles. God chooses to limit his activity to principles that we can understand. That doesn't reflect anything about his nature, just about his decision to do that. Okay, now, that's the general picture of how there can be evil. What I want to talk to you about now is how there can be injury. How there can be injury. Here, I'm fighting an uphill battle because there is, in the popular mind, a certain mental set which you hear over and over again, especially at times when tragedies take place. And although the thought is very comforting, many, many sources disagree. When somebody dies, especially when somebody's killed by a terrorist attack or something like that, you often hear it said that he must have finished his job. He must have had nothing left to do. Such a great person, why else would he die? Or, if the person wasn't such a great person, you say, well, you see, he deserved it. He deserved it. God wanted him to die. What's the reasoning? The reasoning is that if A killed B, and God is really running the world, and God is all-powerful, he knows what's going on, if A managed to kill B, then God must have agreed that B be killed. Otherwise, God wouldn't have allowed it to happen. Or even deeper, when we talk about free will, God is involved in its happening. He's involved in it because every physical event is something which God brings into being, just in a way of fulfilling our free decisions, but he makes it happen. So if he makes it happen, then it must be that God wanted it to happen. So it will come out that A couldn't really injure B. A couldn't do something to B that B didn't deserve, that B didn't God want, God, that God didn't want to happen to B. I just said two phrases there. God couldn't have, it couldn't have happened that A injured B or A killed B without God wanting it to happen to B, because God is in charge, and therefore God must have wanted it to happen. I used several phrases there. I lumped them all together, and they're really different. And part of the fault here is in putting all those phrases together. I'm just trying to make the question seem reasonable. So it will come out that A can't really injure me. Put the point in another way. Let's suppose A injures B. What would have happened if at the last moment A changes mind? So according to the position I'm sketching, well, that's quite extravagant to take away A's free will in order to injure B. But there's another way out.
If God wants him to do it, he's the intermediary to do it. What choice does he have?
And he wasn't meant to be injured.
Okay, but wait a second. I'm taking the supposition in the case where A actually injured B. Now I ask, in that case, with all those conditions in place, what would have happened if A changed his mind at the last minute? What's that?
God changed his mind.
No.
He would not have really changed.
You're coming around. You're being very... It's a much simpler answer.
He would have injured him.
What?
He would not have injured him.
Yes, of course. Had he changed his mind, he has free will, he would not have injured him. What would have happened to B?
He would have been injured some other way.
He would have been injured some other way. A's got there the guns, ready to pull the trigger. Says, oh, how can I kill B? That's not right. It's terrible. So he'd be struck by lightning. There are a lot of ways for God to get rid of B. It has to be through A. Okay, A's willing to do it, so God goes along with that. But if you tell me when A actually kills B, that B had to die, if A decided at the last moment not to kill B, God doesn't have to interfere with A's free will. That's a very, very serious interference. interference with the purpose of creation. God does that only under the most serious cases. If all you want is for B to die, B will die some other way. You can have a heart attack. That's very easy. God's running the guy's physiology. Nobody has to even know. Only A will know. If that's not killing you, drop dead. I wonder why that is. That's this idea. That you really can't injure somebody, that if somebody gets injured through it, human action, it must be that God wanted the person to be injured because God's running the world. And if A succeeds in injuring B, it must be that God wanted B to be injured. Yeah.
Wouldn't it also presuppose that A was the one who had to be doing it? How could he then be found guilty of committing murder in the love of God?
But this is not built into the description that I'm giving. I'm only giving the description. When it says that A injured B, says the disposition I'm describing, that B had to be injured, otherwise God wouldn't have allowed A to injure B. Yeah.
Maybe it was a different way of injuring B, like in a different way.
Correct. That's what I was saying. In other words, according to this position that I'm describing, right, if A had decided at the last moment not to injure B, not to hit B, whatever it is, then B would have been injured some other way.
Maybe God did injure him in a different way, just not visible to us.
There are lots of maybes. I'm just talking about what's necessary. What does my logic require me to hold? This position that says, if A injures B, it's only because B had to be injured. God knows what's happening. God is in control. And if B didn't deserve it, if God hadn't wanted it, those are the two phrases that don't mean the same thing. I'm just putting them together to make the position sound plausible. Then it wouldn't have happened. So if you say that, A managed, succeeded in hurting B, that's only because God wanted B to be hurt, because B needs to be hurt, because B deserves to be hurt. Then I say, it follows from that position, that if A had decided at the last moment not to injure B, then, of course, God really wanted B to be injured, he would have been injured some other way. God would have had him struck by lightning. This is all this position that I'm laying out, which I'm going to deny in a moment. This position sounds reasonable to many people, and you hear it often. But there are many, many sources that disagree with this position. Yeah.
I think it might be kind of what you were saying, but also according to our definition of evil, we couldn't say that any like murder or injury caused would be evil, because like Hashem's will would be present.
No. There's a big difference. I'm glad you asked me, because we said this last week. It's time to review it. There's a big difference between God's will being present and God's will being visible. I said the root of evil is God hiding. That doesn't mean he's not there. Indeed, if you think carefully about it, the only one who has to hide is someone who is there. Because if he's someplace else, he doesn't have to hide. You only have to hide things that are in front of you. If they're not there, then nobody can see them anyhow. So God hides his will. Doesn't mean his will isn't present. His will is present everywhere, all the time. His will is never absent. But it's hidden. That's what we're talking about. And in murder, God's will is spectacularly hidden. Right? Because the murderer is violating God's will, and somebody's suffering, which hides God's purpose in the creation. And so his will is definitely being hidden. Yeah.
I'm trying to clarify, when you say sources support that idea, you're talking mostly secular sources?
No, Jewish sources. Only Jewish sources. I'm not talking about secular sources. What do I care about secular sources? It's not a secular problem. It's not a secular definition.
Right, no, that just didn't sound like a very traditional Jewish approach to it.
I know. That's a surprise. But the sources include the Zohar and Rashi and the Ramban and the Metziv and Rav Dessler and the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Quite a number of very important sources. Okay, now let's start. An example of how this would work. Where the position I just described is wrong.
Yeah. And what? That God cannot interfere with his free will and he changed my method?
No.
Are we going back to that?
No. The position is if A succeeds in injuring B, that's because God wanted B injured because he deserved it and it was time to happen to him. And then if A had decided not to, then God would have engineered B to be injured because that's what he wanted to happen. That's the position.
Maybe that premise is totally wrong.
What's that?
Maybe that premise is wrong.
Well, maybe. I want to show you that it's wrong. Not just maybe. I want to show you that according to important Jewish sources that it's wrong.
But I hear that.
Many people say that. This fellow here says, that doesn't sound like you know, a traditional Jewish position. So I'm going to show you that this position is wrong, and that a traditional Jewish position is really the opposite of that. So you don't hear it very often. Now let's take, this is what the Aruch Haim says it based on the Zohar. The brothers want to kill Reuben. The brothers want to kill Joseph. The brothers decide to kill Joseph.
Brothers.
The brothers have decided to kill Joseph. Reuben says, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Throw him into the pit. And the brothers agree. And they throw Joseph into the pit. The Talmud comments that the pit had in it snakes and scorpions. Asks the Aruch Haim, what is Reuben accomplishing by having them throw Joseph into the pit? If he's going to die in the pit, the snakes and scorpions will kill him. The Torah says explicitly that Reuben's purpose in telling them to throw Joseph into the pit was to save his life. Not to keep their hands free of blood, but to save his life, to bring him back safely to his father. Now, how could Reuben have planned it that way if the pit has in it snakes and scorpions? Okay, now I'm not interested in the answers you could pick up. I'm interested in the Aruch Haim's answer. The Aruch Haim's answer is this. Maybe Joseph had enough merit that in the pit, God will do a miracle and save his life. Which is indeed what happened. But if the brothers get hold of him, they will succeed in killing him. Maybe Joseph's merit is such that if they throw him into the pit, God will do a miracle and save him. But if the brothers get hold of him, they'll succeed in killing him. And under those conditions, Reuben is saving Joseph's life. In other words, let's broaden the picture a little bit. How much merit can a person have? I would put it into three levels. Maybe Joseph is such a great, great righteous person. He's so holy that in the pit, God will do a miracle and save him. And if the brothers get hold of him, God will stop them from killing him also. God will preserve his life no matter what. In that case, Reuben is not saving his life. Reuben's doing nothing. Because he's going to live either way. So why bother tell the brothers to throw him in the pit? Doesn't help. He's going to live either way. Or, it might be that Joseph has so little merit that if the brothers catch him, they'll kill him, and if he's thrown in the pit, the snakes and scorpions will kill him. He'll die either way. In that case, Reuben's doing nothing. He'll die either way. What difference does it make if he throws him in the pit? But his merit might be in between. It might be in between. And in between level, says the Aruch Haim, means that thrown into the pit, God will do a miracle to save him. But if the brothers catch him, they'll kill him. Now, this statement from the Aruch Haim is a direct contradiction to the position that I described. Why? Because the position I described says, if A manages to injure B, we have to assume that if A had changed his mind, B would have been injured by God because he deserved to be injured. He had to be injured. He needed to be injured. God wanted him injured. This description that the Aruch Haim just gave contradicts that. On the contrary. If the brothers get hold of him, they'll kill him, and if he's in the pit, God will save him with a miracle. So this starkly contradicts the position that I described. Now, I've mentioned to some of you on a couple of occasions the difference between a proof and an explanation. You can prove something without understanding why it's so. Just know it's so because it's a proof. Here, the question seems to remain. Okay, I hear the Aruch Haim is saying, but what does God want in a case like this? does God want Joseph alive or dead? It sounds like a contradiction. If in the pit, God will save him with a miracle, that seems to mean that God wants him alive. Now, if God wants him alive, then how can the brothers be strong enough to kill him to overpower what God wants to happen? That's a symptom of the fact we don't have explanation. We just have a proof. I'll give you a couple of more examples of proof, and I'll leave the explanation for tomorrow. So you can think about it. Don't put this on yourself to rabbi questions. I won't answer it tonight. God tells Abraham, your children are going to be in a land that doesn't belong to them. And the people there will oppress them and will enslave them and oppress them. And when they leave, I will judge the people who oppress them. So many commentators ask, if you, God, are decreeing that the Jews should be oppressed, why then are you going to judge and punish the people who oppress them? They're just carrying out what you have decreed should happen. Ramban, one of the commentators who asked this question, gave two answers. One answer is this. God decreed that they should be strangers, they should be enslaved, and they should be oppressed. He did not decree that the oppressor should drown their male newborn babies. That was not part of the decree. That's something which the Egyptians added on their own. And for what they added on their own, they can be judged and punished. Now, this is another direct contradiction to the position I've described. What do you mean they added it on their own? You mean God's decree didn't include that kind of tragedy? Had they managed with their own free will to bring it about without God's decree? Isn't God running everything? If he didn't want it to happen, how did they have the power to make it happen? But that's what it says. That's what it says. The Gemara in Chulin takes the word Mechashev, which means, what we translate as witch, sorcerer, and explains it to me, these people can contradict the heavenly host. Rashi on the spot says, there's a person upon whom it was not decreed that he should die, and these people can engineer he should die. They can manage to kill him, even though it was not decreed in him that he should die. So you see, that even a person who God doesn't want to die, so it seems, doesn't say his time is up, he's used up his rope, you know, or he's committed such crimes that he has to die, and yet, and then, and still the Mechashev can kill him. So these are proofs that this position is a mistake. Now tomorrow I'll review this again to make sure we understand it together, and then I'll give you the explanation. Thank you.